a question was raised last time, and it touches on a certain matter, I would say, a philosophical balance. And since this is important in general, I want to spend a few minutes talking about it. We're talking about free will and the importance of free will. And the question was raised, how do we know that, I mentioned in the name of John Searle that we have certain experiences which naturally lead to the impression that we have free will. We have the experience of deciding. The picture that what we do is just the outcome of the strongest desire we have, or the strongest combination of desire that we have, is inconsistent with the way we actually experience what's going on. If it was a matter just of the stronger of the desires, or the strongest combination of desires working, then when a decision, a need for a decision arises, our reaction would be, well, the desires will fight it out, and whichever is the strongest will do it, so let's just sit back and see what happens. It doesn't require any more input from me. But that's not what happens. What happens is, I'm cognizant of the fact that there are alternatives, and I think about them, and then, the way I experience it, I make a decision. Secondly, as I said last time, it could be that I have several reasons that are relevant to doing a thing, and I choose to do it for one or several of them and not for others of them. Which, as Searle says, we should be astonished at. Because if you thought that the reasons were sort of like forces pushing you, then they're just operating willy-nilly. What do you mean? You choose. But everyone knows what it means to say, well, I had two reasons to do it, but I really did it for this reason, not for that reason. Why did you vote for so-and-so? Well, it's true that he has the best policies. We also happen to go to the same college. Now, both are reasons to vote for him, and I recognize both of them. If you ask me why I did it because he's a college chum. I voted for the college chum. Maybe what I mean is somebody else who's been a college chum with bad policies, I would have voted for him too. So, this is the reason I did it for. So that means that in addition to my background psychology, hopes, fears, desires, needs, scruples, values, in addition to all that, there's another thing, which is the event of making a decision, and that making a decision translates some or all of those reasons into action. Now the question is raised, but maybe this is all an illusion. Sure, it feels that way, seems to be that way, but maybe it's an illusion. Well, maybe it is. I mean, can anybody prove for sure that what we think is not wrong? Nobody can prove anything for sure. That's my view, anyway. Can prove anything for sure. So someone says, maybe it's an illusion. I'm inclined to give him his point, because it's true for anything. Maybe math is an illusion. Maybe my existence is an illusion. Maybe the sky is an illusion. Maybe, who knows? Maybe tables are an illusion. Maybe. Maybe. But then the maybe is too cheap. If all you say is maybe, it applies equally to everything. Is the maybe a reason to think that I'm wrong? I have to then think that I'm wrong about everything, which does seem to be an unreasonable position. So what we say is, maybe it's too cheap. What you need to do is show me some positive reason to think I'm making a mistake. If you show me a positive reason, I'll have to deal with it. If all you can say is maybe, then because that applies equally to everything, I don't really have to deal with it. It's a little deeper than that. And here's the thing I want to teach you, which is important to put in your hip pocket and keep it with you, and it helps you keep your philosophical balance. There is a standard proof that 1 equals 2. Hold on, let me get a piece of paper. I'll just introduce you quickly. You start with A equals B. You square both sides, so you get A squared equals B squared. Then you subtract. I'm sorry, I'm supposed to multiply both sides by A. Right? Multiply both sides by A, then you get A squared equals AB. Then you subtract B squared. A squared minus B squared equals AB minus B squared. Then A squared minus B squared factors to A plus B times A minus B. On this side, you get B times A minus B. Then you divide both sides by A minus B.
Can't do that.
Terrific. I showed you this before. All right, you divide both sides by A minus B, and you get A plus B equals B. Since A equals B, you can substitute B in for A, so you get B plus B equals B. You get 2B equals B. Divide both sides by B, you get 2 equals 1. Now, you see this, and you think, well, that's just algebra. I mean, every step is just algebra. And you get the conclusion of 2 equals 1. So, if you don't know the trick, what do you say? You say, gosh, look at that. Boy, isn't math neat? With math, you can prove 2 equals 1. Boy, it's good to go to school. You can learn all sorts of interesting things. Wait till I go to the Makola, you know, and buy stuff and make change with the salesperson, you know. Boy, am I going to have fun. You know, 2 equals 1. So I'll pay for a $2 thing with $1 and say, see, 2 equals 1. Of course, when she gives me back $1 instead of $2 to change, then we'll do something else, right? Now, obviously what you do here is you say, the conclusion is outrageous. 2 doesn't equal 1. Period. So there's got to be something wrong with the proof, even if you don't know what's wrong with the proof. That's how you go. The point here in logic is this. When you have a proof, all a proof does is set up a tug of war. A tug of war between the premises and the conclusion. It's not given who should win the tug of war. If the conclusion is too outrageous, then what you say is that there's something wrong with the premises. Or something wrong with the logic. A proof doesn't tell you what to believe. Zeno had three proofs that nothing moves. So I'm not going to go through that with you, but he had three proofs that nothing moves, and those proofs were not undone until the middle of the 19th century. That was like 2,300 years. Did anybody say Zeno discovered that nothing moves? No. What they said was, you know, the conclusion is too outrageous, so there's got to be something wrong with the proof. Now, you should beware. If someone offers you a proof of an outrageous conclusion and claims to be a philosophical revolutionary, guess what we've discovered? You ought to ask yourself, what am I more certain of? That conclusion is wrong, or that what he put into the proof is right? And if I'm more certain the conclusion is wrong, I don't have to buy his conclusion. What I can say is, there's got to be something wrong in your proof. Now, this is especially true when the proof rests on philosophy. Because somewhere in the proof, you're using some kind of philosophical premise. Philosophy is very, very weak. It's very weak. Philosophical ideas change every century. And even now, they're all debated one side and another side. So if somewhere in the proof, you're using a philosophical idea, that makes the proof very weak. And it isn't worthy to enforce the outrageous conclusion. One should say, I'm sorry, the conclusion is outrageous, and therefore I'd rather deny the philosophical part that you put in. Now, there are people called skeptics. People called skeptics try to prove to you that you don't know what you think you know. And here's how they do it. They say, you think you know it, prove it. So you give your reasons, and they say, look, that's not a proof. You could still be wrong. And they show you ways in which you could possibly be wrong. The skeptic paints himself as someone with no commitments. This was Socrates' position. You go, I don't know anything. But you say you know something. Let's hear your reasons. We'll examine your reasons. So the skeptic has no commitments. Only you have commitments. And then he undermines your commitments. That's a false picture. That's a false picture. The skeptic also has a commitment. He's committed to a certain definition of proof. He says, give me a proof. Because what he doesn't tell you, in an undertone, is, it's got to be my kind of proof. Kind of proof that I'll recognize. Kind of proof that I think is a correct proof. He has a philosophical definition of proof that he's using. And when he convicts you of failing to provide a proof, he's really leaning on his philosophical definition of proof. So a way out is for you to say, true, I don't have a proof of the kind that you recognize. That just shows that you got the wrong definition of proof. Look, I'm very sure that I know this. How sure am I of your definition of proof? Not at all. Because your definition of proof is a piece of abstract speculative philosophy. That stuff is very weak. So a reasonable way out is to say, if you're trying to show me I don't know anything, you know, peddle it at the ice cream parlor. Don't try to sell it to me. What do you mean I don't know anything? Obviously, I know lots of things. If I can't produce your kind of proof, that just means you've got the wrong kind of proof. Since Descartes, 350 years ago, who argued that we don't know anything for sure, the whole game in epistemology has been to find a definition of proof which isn't for sure. Okay, I don't know anything for sure. That doesn't mean I don't know anything. It just means I know it by a different standard. For 350 years, people have been beating around in the bushes trying to find another standard which isn't absolute certainty, but is reasonable. And I've not succeeded. But one thing they all agree on is we shouldn't draw the conclusion we don't know anything. That's dumb. We're facing a very difficult problem. How to define what an adequate proof is. So, Nolan William Lycan uses this in Free Will. So listen, it's obvious to me that I'm responsible for what I do. And if you think that by questioning free will, you're going to get to the conclusion that I'm not responsible, that can't be. Because when you question free will, you're using loads and loads of philosophy. Gobs and gobs of philosophy. Whatever that philosophy is, I'm surely not as convinced of that as I am that I'm responsible for what I do. So I'm not going to be convinced by your philosophy that I'm not responsible. Your philosophy isn't strong enough to derive a conclusion like that. Now, the same thing's true here. A fact of common experience, and the fact of common experience lead people to naturally assume, I don't think there's anybody on the planet who hasn't been corrupted by philosophy, who dreams that he isn't making free decisions for what he does. Even psychologists who pretend that man is determined in what he does somehow fail to apply this to their own choice of a psychological theory. Somehow it never reaches that level. Yeah, all you guys are determined in your politics and in your love life and your economics, but I, the psychologist, when I adopted this psychological theory, I did it because it's true, and I'm searching for the truth, and I found the truth. He doesn't think of himself as determined by ice cream cones down the pipe, you know, or by his upbringing and by his culture. No. Somehow the psychological theory that he's using is really true because that's his profession, right? That's his bailiwick. So if someone wants to convince me that I don't really make decisions, he needs an argument that doesn't rest on philosophy. He needs an argument that rests on something that's stronger, clearer, I'm more committed to, more obvious to me than that I make decisions. That'll be an uphill battle. It's still possible to do, but it'll be an uphill battle.
Do you think it's possible for a physical system to manifest what we observe as real?
A physical system to manifest what we observe as free will.
Right.
Well, I suppose that ought to be an open question. We don't know much about the capacities of physical systems.
Right.
But that would only mean, as some philosophers say, that maybe physical systems can have free will.
Okay.
I mean, John Searle, who gave these examples that I gave, he believes that the human being is a physical system. He believes that the free will that we experience psychologically has to be paralleled by a lack of determinism in the brain on the basis of quantum mechanics. It can't be purely push-pull all the way down. Otherwise, it would be an illusion. So you'll have to have a physical system which isn't purely mechanical. And that you can have, because we know quantum mechanics leaves gaps. So, you know. But the idea that all the way down, it's a washing machine, all the way down, it's just, you know, nuts and bolts, that's going to be very difficult. It's very hard for us to imagine a physical system behaving in a way where the reasons are all there, but the reasons do not by themselves cause the outcome. And the outcome is caused by something called a decision, which makes the reasons active, which is the way we experience it. And then he has a kind of evolutionary argument against it. He says, if it really were true that we're nuts and bolts all the way down, and that our decisions, our feeling that we're making a free decision is an illusion, then this whole aspect of our psychology, of going through the deliberations and making the decisions, would really have nothing to do with what we actually perform. Then it's a gigantic waste of effort. And evolution is not known to program things to have a gigantic waste of effort, because when you waste effort, you usually ain't go instinct to go disease, you know, because you're competing with other animals that don't have that waste of effort. So this is the way he puts it in this book that I'm quoting from. Anyway, I'm just saying that anything which is obvious and clear and simple, and it's part of our all universal experience, if somebody wants to undermine it, he's got to give me something that's even more obvious. And then, yes, indeed, you can learn new things. There's no question about it. The fact that it's obvious doesn't mean it's necessarily true. It just sets the bar for how big the challenge has to be. The challenge has to be really very solid. And it better not be philosophical. Philosophical philosophy isn't strong enough to do that. Yeah.
What's an example of something that was obvious and was tried to be proven wrong, and so it was something else that was more that was also more and more obvious than it was brought up?
That the Earth is stationary. You tell somebody 2,000 years ago the Earth is moving, they'd laugh you out of the room.
What?
People thought the Earth was flat.
I'm not using that. I'm using stationary. As a matter of fact, 2,400 years ago, there was also already enough information to show that the Earth is round. And some people knew it. But that it's stationary is much more difficult. No, I mean, can't you see? What's the matter with you? You're sitting on it. Well, can't you see it's not moving? And if we're moving, wouldn't the wind be whistling through my hair? I mean, you know, it's just obvious. Now, I'll prove it to you. Climb up a tower, a high tower, a straight tower, right? Take a rock and drop it. Now, if the Earth is moving, while the rock is falling, the Earth will move out from under it. So either the rock will crash into the wall of the tower as the tower moves into the path of the rock, or the rock will fall some distance from the tower as the tower moves away. But it doesn't do that. It falls straight down to the bottom. Now, how many more proofs do you need? Right? Everybody sees it. I have proofs that it's so. It's obvious. And it's not so. Well, then you do an experiment with a pendulum. You set a pendulum going. And you let go for 24 hours, the plane in which the pendulum swings goes round. It turns round. The pendulum turns round every 24 hours. Why is it doing that? My gosh, I don't know. I mean, somebody's pushing it there. Gremlins, you know, or elves. How could it go around? It's just being pushed back and forth. You know, it's on a swivel. So that as the base goes around, the swivel would hold it steady. Wouldn't go around. And yet it goes around. Answer is, we're going around. It's really going straight. It's not moving, we're moving, and we're going around. Well, how come I don't feel the wind whistling through my hair? The answer is because as the Earth moves, the wind moves also. So as the Earth moves, the wind moves also. So I can't really use the wind to tell whether the Earth is moving or not. I drop the stone from the tower. But what you've forgotten is that just as you and the tower and the Earth are moving, that gives motion to the stone also. So when you drop it, it doesn't fall straight down. It falls in a curve given the motion that it had from the motion, from the earth movement. So of course it's going to drop right next to the top. What happens here, now I'm borrowing from Thomas Nagel, what happens here is this. The attack has two parts. Number one, you show me something that I see with my eyes, which I can't explain. How come the pendulum goes around? If the earth is stationary, that's beyond my ability to explain. Number two, you take away all my evidence. You take away all my evidence by pointing out that even if I'm wrong, everything I use as evidence could still be true. If you can do both of those things, then I might have to give up. But you have to do both. It's not enough to point out that everything might be set up and I can't tell the difference. That's not enough. And it's not enough just to point out that something's against me. If I think that I have all this gigantic evidence on my side, okay, pendulums are very strange. Okay. No. But towers are right, and the hair in my the wind in my hair is right, and the fact that I'm sitting on the floor is right. So this one thing called a pendulum, I wouldn't give up for that. But then he says to me, listen, the wind and the tower and just sitting on the floor don't mean anything. They don't mean anything. They're equal. They're equal both ways. And I have the pendulum against you. At that point, I'll give up. You follow me? Take the flatness of the earth. Somebody says, oh, the earth is round. It's just very, very, very big. So you can't tell that it's round. You know, give me a break. Why should I say that? I see it's flat. Maybe what I see is not right. Because I'm in very little space, and the thing is gigantic. And, you know, if you see the whole gigantic thing, you know, I mean, maybe it's turtles all the way down. I mean, maybe it's made of microscopic mosquitoes. Who knows? You're making up something that I can't see and saying, maybe it's like that. There's no answer, maybes. But if you ask someone to measure a shadow of the sun, at noon, in different cities, north or further north and south, you'll find the shadow isn't the same length. Why is that? I mean, if it's flat, the sun's over there, so, and at night, you look at the north star, depending on where you are on the sea, it's either higher or lower from the surface. And as the ship comes to you, when you see it coming to port, first you see the sails, and then you see the hull. Why is that? So now, number one, I have to admit that if the earth were very big, I wouldn't be able to tell that it was round. And number two, now I have certain observations which do seem to indicate that it's round. Now I'm in trouble. Now I have to reconsider. So these are the things which led people 2,400 years ago, the intelligentsia, to think that the earth probably is round. That's the thing, Gather. But so in other words, just suggesting there's another possibility and you can't tell the difference isn't good enough. And just finding a piece of counter evidence isn't good enough because I got rafts and rafts of evidence that I'm right. But if you do both, then you might be able to undo it. You need to have another possibility for which I can't tell the difference, and you have to have something positive against my possibility. Then you might do it. What happens in amateur philosophy, sometimes even in professional philosophy, is that the person says, you believe X, notice that Y could also be true and you couldn't tell the difference. That's not enough. The fellow who invented this line of thinking, or used it, I guess, most directly, was D.E. Moore. There are questions about how do you know there is an external world. Maybe you're dreaming, you know, maybe who knows, if your evidence is good, maybe close your eyes and it disappears, and so forth and so on. So he said, I have a proof that there's an external world. Here's my proof. Here's one hand. Here's two hands. Hands are part of the external world. So it's an external world. That's the proof. So everybody said, you know, but the whole question was, do you have hands? I mean, the hands are part of the external world. It's just as bad about hands as it is about ships or you know, cattle or anything else. So what he meant was this. What are you more certain of? Are you more certain of the philosophical argument that your evidence isn't really good enough, or that you have hands? Gosh, you know, you ought to be more certain that you have hands, right? The philosophy is pure speculation. Everybody has a different view, and in 100 years they'll all have different views. So if it's a competition between this particular philosophy and my having hands wins. And it wins in logic. You can't destroy your belief that you have hands on the grounds of some philosophical speculation. Philosophical speculation is just not strong enough. At any rate, that's just designed to help you keep your balance as you go through these matters. Okay. We were starting chapter 3 in part 1. Now, what we said was that man was created to have free choice, and therefore he's given a solving against a ra, good inclination, evil inclination, because free will only applies when there's competition, when there's a struggle, when there's being pulled in these two directions. The way he's given a good inclination and evil inclination is because it's composed of a soul and a body. And that means the soul and the body are in a constant state of that. Now, if you look carefully at his vocabulary, you'll see an asymmetry in the way he describes the as a conclusion that I mentioned to you before that's very important. He says, there's a battle between the soul and the body in such a way that if the soul prevails, is the stronger, overcomes, then it goes up and the body goes up with it. And that person will be, he will have achieved the perfection that was assigned for him. And if the person will allow the physical to conquer him, then the body will go down and the soul will go down with it. And that person will be unfit for perfection, and he will be deprived of it, pushed away from it, has to show. Now look, there are two very important things here. The person, the soul, if the soul goes up, the body goes up with it, and the person achieves perfection. Who's the person? The combination of soul and body. Not just the soul, the person. It's the soul and the body together that achieve perfection. So if the soul is stronger, and then it rises and it brings up the body with it, and he achieves perfection. And if the person will let the body, the material, conquer, what does that mean? It means where's the control? No. Listen again. If the soul wins the battle, then the soul goes up and the body goes up with it. And if the person will let the body win, what does that mean? It means the body doesn't have the control to win. It can't. The body can't win. Everything is in the hands of the person or the soul. Only the person or the soul will exert itself to win, then it wins. And if it allows the body, but the control is with the person. The person always has the power to win. At least on this level, on the level of autumn, we didn't come to history yet. It's what he doesn't say, what we're worried about last week. He doesn't say, if the soul is stronger, then these are gone. And if the body is stronger, because then it would be out of his hands. No, the body can't be strong. It's just that a person can, through his choice, allow the body to win the battle. The body can't be inherently stronger. If it were, then it's a mechanical thing, whichever happens to be stronger. God created them, and it's a game of solitaire. We're not playing any role at all. Now, this effort has a fixed period of time. That's what we call this world. And then after we are finished with that period of effort, then we come to the period of pure reward.
which doesn't involve any effort at all. Why? Why is it that way? Why couldn't we have this world forever? A world of striving, a world of efforts, a world of success and failure. For every success, there'll be an elevation and an acquisition of some level of perfection. And for every failure, there'll be a loss of perfection and a descent. And then just let that go on forever.
Because that wasn't God's original plan.
I know, but we're asking why wasn't it God's original plan? Why couldn't it be?
God originally wanted it to be perfect in the first place. But because of the original sin, he had to come up with plan B, which is the way it is now.
Oh, no. We are now talking before the original sin.
Before the original sin.
Yes, that's the point. We're talking now about the world before Adam was created, the world into which Adam was created. That'll be a further concept. Why? God wanted to do good. He wanted to give this creature an opportunity to acquire as much perfection as a creature can acquire. So he created the creature with free will to be self-determined. So let it exercise free will and self-determine itself forever. Why must there be a cutoff point that, okay, we're having so many thousands of years of self-determining, and after that, it finishes. And after that, we'll just have the consequences of the efforts. Why not have the consequences of the efforts in this world? I keep striving. I must tell you that it's a little scary, the idea of giving up action, giving up not having action, not having creativity, not doing anything, but just having things happen. Given the way we're built, and given the way, I don't know, maybe you are at heart a couch potato. I enjoy the challenge of the striving and so forth. So why wouldn't a world, a creation, where this goes on forever be satisfactory? And the answer lies in what I told you last time. In order to set up a world in which we can strive, God has to cluck and hide his presence very, very significantly. Which means the level of good that can be achieved in this world is very low. It's very low. It's very low because the conditions under which you have to strive require God to be missing most of the time. If the goal includes being in communion with God, enjoying God's presence, as it does, then this world can't have it. A world of striving can't be a world in which God's presence is open and you can feel that open, clear connection with Him, like the angels do. That takes away free will. So we're in an artificial position where our ability to enjoy perfection is very, very reduced. So that we'll be able to strive for it. Later, when we get it, it'll have the double benefit. It'll have the intensity of a direct experience, and it'll have the benefit that we created it. It's sort of like, I don't know if I said this to last time, or I said it to somebody who asked me afterwards. You want to buy a mansion, and you work and you save and you invest, and it takes you 15 years to amass the money to buy it, and then you buy it. And you buy it outright. You know, no mortgage. It just belongs to you, free and clear. So now you don't have to work anymore to earn the money for it. I don't think that means you won't enjoy it. I think you'll enjoy it plenty. And you'll enjoy it all the more so that you bought it. You worked, you earned the money, and you bought it. And that enjoyment is not going to fade with time. After 15 years, what did I do to earn it? You know, the last year, nothing, so I'm not going to enjoy it. Because I bought it with the money that I earned. So it's enough to have the initial stage where you put in the effort. Then when you get what you get, and you get it because you earned it, it has that benefit that you earned it, plus its own natural intensity. Now, he says, in order for a person to really have free will, he has to have the ability to act, and there shouldn't be anything that stops him. Whatever actions are necessary to achieve perfection, and then you have to be able to do the opposite. Otherwise, you're not acting, you're not choosing.
which means he has to have the ability to act in such a way as to strengthen the physical and to leave the intellectual aside and to ignore it. Because even though it would seem maybe better for God to program us with a pure intellect, program us with good personality traits, program us with being superior to and independent of the material. But that's not true. Because if so, then we would just be very fancy squirrels. And a very fancy squirrel can't be godlike at all. So therefore, there's two worlds. There's this world and the next world. This world of striving and the next world where we receive the ultimate reward. Although some reward can be received in this world in the sense of attachment to God. Some attachment to God is available in this world. But it's within the limits of God's hiddenness in this world. And therefore it is greatly limited, far greater limitation than is appropriate for really receiving the reward. Now he says something very important. I don't know if I understand it 100%. I understand it a reasonable amount. Adam was created just like that. 50-50. Soul and body. Each equal in power. So that the choice would really be a 50-50 choice. And then, had he made the right choice, he would have been able to overcome in one shot. In one shot, he would have overcome the resistance, and he would have purified the physical, and that would have been the end of the striving that he had to do. But he failed. As a result of his failure, the whole world changed. The picture that he gives is this. It's hinted at here, and it's more explicit than other writers. If you imagine Adam in Gan Eden, he had a soul and a body. There's a spiritual side and a physical side. Now, when he chooses wrongly and is expelled from the Garden of Eden, the whole creation takes a whole step down. If he's over here, now he's over here. Which means that what we call in our world the spiritual, for him that would have been comparable to the physical level. His spiritual level is out of our picture. We have no connection to it. It's hidden from us. And our physical level was brought into existence by his action. Didn't exist before. The whole of the universe, the person, the physical universe, the angels, everything took a giant step down. Which means that the physical side now is much stronger and the spiritual side is much weaker. So it isn't 50-50 anymore. It is not 50-50 anymore. It's, I don't know, 70-30. Here's a symptom of it, he says. Adam was created as an adult. So he had the full-fledged spiritual and the full-fledged physical coming simultaneously at war with one another and then having to make a choice. Now, the child is born wholly physical. The child starts out with no spiritual aspect whatsoever. It is immersed in the physical totally. And the spiritual side grows very slowly. It doesn't mature until the ages of 12 or 13, depending upon whether it's a girl or a boy. So the physical has a great head start in anchoring the identity of the person. Secondly, our condition of life is such that we are immersed in the physical in terms of our needs. In Gan Eden, the food was free. the trees provided it. You didn't have to do anything. Just take. Okay, you had to eat whatever eating was for them. But that's all. Now, you have to immerse yourself in the physical in order to just provide physical. So your mind, your consciousness, remember how we said last week why the physical is inherently evil. The physical is inherently evil because it hides God. When you are involved in the physical, you are in great danger of losing sight of God. Okay, but Adam could say, I don't have to involve myself in the physical. What do I have to do? I just take an apple. What's the big deal? But we can't do that, though. We have to plow and plant and water and pray that the bugs don't get the food and then finally get it harvested. So we're studying the physical to figure it out, and we're taking great efforts to invest in the physical. So we're immersed in the illusion. We're wallowing in the illusion. So it's much, much more difficult. Then he adds a point, which I don't understand. He said, not only is the situation worse, but we created it for ourselves. We brought it about. That is to say, Adam brought it about by his choice. And that makes it much worse. It'd be bad enough if God, for whatever reason, imposed it upon us. That may be styro physical and that we have to engage in the physical. But he brought it about by himself. That makes it even worse. I'm not quite sure why it makes it even worse. But that's what he says. In other words, the situation we're in now is that we are in a much, much worse position. Now, yeah.
You mentioned about the physical dominating the life of a baby. I mean, I remember learning, I've got a question on that I learned, about that a child's born with a yetzer hara only, and the yetzer tov only comes in a bar mitzvah. So, I mean, how does that get in line with saying that unless you have two different directions of pulling, you don't have free will? Is that like saying that a child below 13 doesn't have free will?
That's exactly what it would mean. And it's even worse than that because it's a complicated subject. It does seem to be somewhat gradual. It doesn't seem to be that all of a sudden the 13 totally changes his character. So whether there's some deep element that we're not seeing on the surface, the ultimate motivation for which he's doing it, or whether it is gradual, and a 13-year-old is only responsible in an earthly court. Our sources say that when you're responsible in the heavenly court is only the age of 20. I hope this doesn't encourage you to be responsible for some months, or however long it is. Because credit you can always get. But you're not liable, not because you're not fully responsible until the age of 20. So, it does seem to be, to a certain extent, a gradual matter. But the point that I made, or the point that Rosado makes, still stands. The physical has a great advantage. Now, there are two points that I want to take care of. I'll just get one. Let's ask a radical question. He failed. Why must I suffer? Autumn failed. Good. Why must I be born into such a degraded world? Give me my shot. Give me a gun. Like me 50-50. Maybe I'll do better than he. Why is it fair that the rest of mankind should be born into a reduced world, a lower world, because Adam and Chava say? The answer is, ladies and gentlemen, that you and I were there because Adam had in him the whole of mankind. Every human being, since him, is a slice of him. His soul is what you could call a world soul. And it contains the whole of humanity. And every human being thereafter is a slice of Adam. So we were all there, and we all participated in it, and we're all living out the consequences of our own decision. And the Medrash like this. Tzatzah didn't have to invent it. Medrash says each human soul, since Adam is a slice of Adam, so each person is really living out the consequences of the decision of which he was a signatory. And therefore it's not unfair. Okay, continue tomorrow.